This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
The Blue Cliff Record, Case 28. Nansen went to see Master Pai Chang. Chang asked, "Have all the sages since antiquity had a truth they haven't spoken for people?" Nansen said, "They have." Chang said, "What is the truth that hasn't been spoken for people?" Nansen said, "It's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not anything." Chang said, "You just said it." Nansen said, "I am just this. What about you?" And Chang said, "I'm not a great man of knowledge. How should I know whether it's been spoken or not?" Nansen said, "I don't understand." Chang said, "I've already spoken too much." In the verse, patriarchs and Buddhas never helped people. Patched robe monks present and past, running neck and neck. When bright mirrors are on their stands, the range of images differ. One by one, they all face south and see the Northern Dipper. The Dipper handle is hanging down. There's no place to seek. When you pick up your nostrils, you lose your mouth. You can imagine Nansen and Pai Chang here as Dharma brothers challenging each other. The Mumon Khan contains the first part of this story and ends with Nansen having the last word. It's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not anything. And in presenting it that way, it makes it look like he is the elder and is giving the last word. Not mind, not Buddha, not a thing. Blue Cliff Record gives the longer account and gives Pai Chang the last word. What are we to make of the question? Is there some teaching, some truth that the sages, the patriarchs, have never preached? In a way, it sounds like it's asking for something, you know, one last final esoteric secret, right? What's the real deal that nobody's ever been let in on, right? And of course, we can always fantasize that there's one more big thing to learn that's been withheld or that we still need to discover for ourselves. That's its own kind of fantasy that we have to pursue to its end. But I think that another way to think of this question is Pai Chang challenges Nansen and asks, is there a truth you can speak that doesn't simply echo the teachings of all the patriarchs and sages. Do you have anything original to say? Do you have any words of your own, right? Is there some truth that you can utter that isn't just you handing down what you've always heard from everybody else? Nonsense has a lot of courage here. It says, yes, I can, right? It says, well, what is it? And Nonsense says, it's not mind. It's not Buddha. It's not a thing, right? What I've been taught all these years is it's all mind. Everything is Buddha, right? Well, no mind, no Buddha. In a sense, he's saying, kill the Buddha, right? Forget the mind. The Pai Chang says, as soon as you say that, you've created another cliche, right? Now everybody's going to run around and say, not mind, not Buddha, right? You're going to get generations of students saying, I don't know, right? Right? So this is always the challenge. As soon as you open your mouth, you either parrot something you've heard before, or if God forbid you say something original, pretty soon everybody around you is parroting you. And that doesn't feel very good either. So when Nonsense is challenged like that, he's able to sort of bow and acknowledge this and sort of say, well, what about you? And Pai Chang gets in this great line where he says, I'm not some great Zen master. How should I know? This is a wonderful, wonderful answer. Nonsense tries to mirror it and say, I don't understand. Right. Pai Chang ends, I've already spoken too much. Right? To speak anything risks the danger of it becoming the new answer. Right? I think that we can take this dialogue back to the questions we were asking yesterday about how do you answer when someone asks you what is the meaning of coming to Linwood, right? What is the reason you practice? What do you get out of it? How are you going to sum up the truth of this for people? And it's a very hard question. And as we were saying the other day, I think that inevitably we come for all sorts of complicated, self-centered reasons. And that practice is, in a sense, designed to draw out all those curative fantasies and gradually give them a chance to wear themselves out. But what are we left with? Is there any way to speak about what we're left with afterwards? The verse says, patriarchs and Buddhas never helped anybody. And they say the Buddha never preached, you know, in all his 40 years of teaching. In therapy training, they used to have an expression, the helping hand strikes again. Right? You know, and I think Thoreau had a line somewhere. He says, if I see somebody coming down the path with the intention to help me, I run out the back door, right? So often helping comes with some agenda, right? Every child and every parent knows this, right? Every parent has some idea of what being a good parent is. And inevitably, there are aspects of that that backfire. The idea of helping always has some implicit or sometimes explicit agenda of what the good outcome is supposed to look like. My father thought an education was very important and I should really, you know, go to school and study, and in the end I could become any kind of doctor I wanted, right? That was, you know, it was the path clearly had a prescribed endpoint, right? So parents and teachers all sort of have to learn about what counts as helping, right? And what counts as this kind of controlling helping hand that can do good up to a point, but which in a way will always contain seeds of its own failures. See, sometimes we try to find a way to practice that just cuts through all our preconceptions of what this is. I ask people to just look out the window and watch the river. I don't know if any Buddha or patriarch has ever taught that before, right? But I don't want it to turn into the technique. Oh, now that's what magic teaches. He has people just look at the river, right? Very hard to do something simple without reifying it into the next thing that is a technique that you do well or badly. Sesshin is this very strange dialectic between structure and effort, and just leaving yourself alone, just sitting, just seeing what shows up in the mirror. We are told to study the way is to study the self, and then to study the self is to forget the self. Most people are in a hurry to get to forget the self. And Sesshin, I think, always has a kind of back and forth between those two things, studying the self, or probably more like being confronted with the self, having the self just be right there in front of you in a way that you can't ignore. You know, the idea of David Foster Wallace, I believe, said, Don't worry about getting in touch with your feelings. They'll get in touch with you. That's what Sesshin does, right? You don't have to go looking for the self. It's going to force itself, you know, on your attention. Particularly day after day, as things get difficult or boring or repetitive or not the way you like, all our self-judgments about how everybody else is doing things and all our judgments about how we're doing start to come out and display themselves, sometimes privately, sometimes publicly. In that sense, Sesshin is all about studying the self, your own repetitive versions of trying to control and fix and avoid and judge, right? All these just come out one time after another, right? Sometimes they come out so painfully that it all just turns to ashes in your mouth, right? And the self just is something that you see as, oh my God, I've been doing that, right? And sometimes that just allows things to fall away. But there's other sides of Sesshin where we do allow ourselves to finally just sit with nothing to do and nothing to particular to be. Sometimes we can do that sitting at the wall. Sometimes we'll do it just watching the river, where all there is then is the river. And we watch all the ways the light moves on the river and the water moves and the clouds and the sky and the trees. And if for a little while, maybe we forget about who's watching. There's just the river. All our attention is on how it's changing and none particularly on what we're doing. And for a few moments, the self is forgotten. There's just the river. And then we'll come back and the self is there just as big as life all over again. And we have to go through this dialectic back and forth over and over and over again. And why do we do it? Eventually, I think it's just something we do. I think that, you know, I don't think any more about what I get out of Sesshin. It's just something I do. I probably could say that I'm a kind of person who just likes a fair degree of structure and routine and discipline in their life. I like that sort of thing, right? I don't like being at loose ends. I'm a thank God it's Monday kind of person, you know? But it's, you know, I was thinking it's like, how are people drawn to music or art? You know, sometimes kids are made to take piano lessons. Sometimes kids grow up wanting to be Eric Clapton, right? Maybe it's voluntary, maybe it's involuntary, but they start doing this thing. They start playing and practicing. And after a while, the original motivation doesn't have much to do with anymore. The music just becomes part of their lives and it's what they do and who they are. And sitting can be like that. We all get into it for crazy reasons, but after a while, it becomes something we do. You know, may not have to make a profession out of it, But you can, you know, just have something that's really part of the way you live and structure your life. It becomes a habit. And if anybody says, why do you do that? Well, I don't know. You know, it's just it's something I've been doing a long time. Can be a very unsatisfying answer, right? And yet, there's something about not knowing particularly what it is or why you do it that leaves it more open-ended, more free from any kind of particular means to an end kind of thinking. You know, I remember in San Diego after some Dharma talk, people were saying, what difference did Zazen make their life? And I remember one woman who so very earnestly said, my room is a lot neater now. You know, I think that's the kind of byproduct, you know, practice sometimes has in your life. But it would, you know, I don't think anybody would say, I practice in order to get to be a better bed maker, a neater person. But things happen. As in this dialogue, we end up with, I don't understand. I've already said too much, right? Which I think is probably a good place to end.